Всім добрий вечір. Всі ми тут.
On behalf of the brave. We have freedom. Give us wings to protect.
Наші військові тут, громадяни суспільства тут, всі ми тут. Захищаємо нашу незалежність, нашу державу. Так буде і далі. Слава нашим захисникам, слава нашим захисницям. Слава Україні!
Good day, everyone. Very happy to see you here. The space is populating nicely. It is August. I guess many people are on holiday. But I'm very, very glad to be speaking today with Rachel Semba. It's the second time we speak. The last time was almost a year ago. And now we're going to be able to have a second take at her unique way of looking at the economy in general and trade in particular. Good day, Rachel. How do you do?
Thanks for having me. It's always good to chat. You all sort of follow everything so closely, so I'm glad to be with you my morning, but your afternoon, wherever you are around the world. So look forward to the conversation.
So do I. So very quickly, a quick introduction for those of you who have seen some light in and have let themselves into this space. We are Totony. This is a special interview with Rachel Semba. We are a group of international volunteers who are trying to attract attention on the conflict in Ukraine, as well as collect information and distribute it as far and wide as possible. Rachel, on the other hand, is, well, I would say you're mostly an advisor in economics. You write very interesting papers. But how would you define yourself, especially over the past few months? How have things changed for you?
Sure. So, yes, I mean, I do think of my work as economic or sort of political economic, geoeconomic advisor to a range of entities. I work with companies who are trying to understand how trade flows and even how sort of sanctions and other policies are affecting them. But I also sort of try to keep an eye on and give some advice to government actors and the like in thinking about the impact of these measures as well. So I think that always important to both understand where a range of government actors are thinking about issues, but also where the pain points or non-pain points are for the private sector in that way. But it's really sort of looking at economic issues, the intersection of politics and economics, commodity flows, which of course are tools of both economics and politics, you know, and currencies, and looking at the ways that both these are weaponized, you know, sort of by, you know, by all sides, and also the limitations of some of the economic side of warfare. So, I mean, my background is as someone who tracks global macro, you know, trends, but it's increasingly been tracking sanctions and other tools like that, as well as government investments. And that's obviously a lot of time thinking about sort of Russia and the war and how things are changing, but also other sanctioned entities, whether it's Iran or Venezuela. And of course, the last couple of weeks, I've been quite focused on what might or might not happen in the BRICS summit that's still going on today in South Africa. So anyway, that was a very long introduction of who I am and what I do.
No, it was perfectly sized. All right, for the conversation today, so I'd like to speak with you about everything from industrial policy to finance, monetary issues, also trade. But for the sake of not speaking for a full 8 hours, I wanted to focus on global trade and the impact of the Russian invasion of Ukraine on global trade. If you're okay with this, I'd like to cover three main points. The first one is the fundamentals, the basic supply chains, looking at the whole picture. The second point I'd like to look at is particularly policies and the role of states, and as you mentioned, groups of states in the case of the BRICS summit. And the last one, I wanted to have something maybe a bit more precise on some sectors and on some questions that you think deserve to be particularly looked at. You okay with this construction?
Sure. Let's see how it goes. So where would you like to start? Just how the trade, you know, sort of how some of the trade flows have evolved, or, you know, it's happy to dive in where we find most interesting.
Yeah, if you were looking at trade statistics for the world or for large regions, and you were looking at pre-February 22nd, after February 22nd, what would be the large changes that you would observe, or would there be any?
There are quite a number. I think the biggest one has been the shift in where Russia sells its commodities, especially oil, to some extent, natural gas, fertilizer, grain, which I'm sure we'll sort of come back to. And the net result, which maybe, you know, happened in fits and starts, has been a shift to much more direct sales to, you know, to Asia, that sort of reinforced the trend. But, you know, also, you know, we can, you know, sort of get into rerouting. So the first thing is that Russia is selling much more of its commodities, you know, to the east. It's also selling a lot more through intermediaries. There are much longer journeys that these commodities take to get to their end users. And then the other trend has been that, you know, before February, you know, sort of February 2022, we had, you know, not only a lot of Russian gas and energy sales to Europe, there was a sizable flow of items going, you know, to Europe, from Europe into Russia. And so the countries that are still trading with Russia, providing them with equipment, at least directly, tend to be in Asia, tend to be in the Middle East. And on both the import and the export side, there's a lot more trade through intermediaries, sort of longer journeys, more less licit, less legal channels, and a lot more sort of middlemen companies sort of in between there. So those are some of the major ones. Now, I also think that there are other trends that we have to unpack at a global level, which include the fact that over the last few years, not only was there sort of recovery and lessons learned from the global pandemic, which of course caused its own economic and trade disruption, but also this has been taking place in a time of greater U.S.-China competition, some, you know, redirection of trade routes, a push towards nearshoring and friendshoring, and a lot more items that go into the U.S. still coming from Asia, but not coming directly from China. Maybe coming from Southeast Asia. And so that's also, it's not directly a cause of the war by any means, but it is a cause of and a contribution of both the extensive tariffs that were sort of put in place under the Trump administration and kept on in the Biden administration, and a series of export controls that are used vis-a-vis China by the U.S. government. So all of that, I think, has reinforced some shifts in global trade. You know, and the like. Those are, I think, some of the big ones on the trade side. The other, of course, big one, and it does move the needle a bit, you know, sort of internationally, is the fact that, of course, Russia, who was already trying to de-dollarize, is now conducting most of its trade in renminbi. Now, that's relatively small on the global level, just because, you know, Russia's, you know, a large country, but not one of the largest ones. But sort of on the margin, Russia has contributed to a bit of an increase in trade settlement in renminbi in the Chinese currency. That's coincided with some interest in de-dollarization from other countries. Aside from Russia, I don't think the moves at a global level are that great, but it is something we're watching, and I think there's a lot of rhetoric around this. Why don't I stop there? I'm sure I've said some things that you might want me to follow up on or sort of listeners might have some comments on.
Yeah, absolutely. Mostly interested at the moment on the question of the size, the impact.
Yeah.
When we look at the situation from Ukraine or from the point of view of people who are interested in Ukrainian victory, every time there's a single tanker going one way or another way, we find it not only interesting, but important. Yes. But from the global point of view, how important has been the impact of the both effect that you mentioned first, the war itself, second, the China v. U.S. sort of fight that has started.
Yeah. So I think the war itself had, you know, has had sort of a few phases of impact on the global global economy, including, talked about a redirection of trade. Of course, that doesn't necessarily happen super smoothly. You know, we had, especially last year, big spikes in key commodity prices, both food and fuel. The U.S. came in with efforts to keep Russian fuel flowing, but to pay them less for it, and that contributed to easing of global energy prices, along with the fact that the Chinese economy is facing a lot of internal problems that's leading to sort of softer demand. And, you know, and I think we're seeing again, especially over the last sort of few weeks, this real increase in prices of, you know, food prices that is, you know, sort of especially since the formal exit from the grain deal and the increased militarization of Black Sea trade, or I should say military threats to Black Sea trade, both, you know, sort of especially Ukrainian supplies, but also Russian ones as well. And, you know, and I think that only reinforces the impacts on global food security from climatic extremes, right? We have seen impacts of drought around the global economy. So some of the challenges we try to unpack the impact of the war is how does it maybe reinforce other challenges and vulnerabilities? You know, and then, of course, we have seen, you know, Ukrainian exports have significant, volatility, both, you know, periods of time last year where it was very difficult to get supplies, particularly of grain, but also sort of other products out, new supply chains operating, and, you know, just sort of a lot more costs in doing that. So I think we have a number of trends going on at the same time. You know, Ukraine's exports have obviously have fallen off, despite the fact that they have sort of companies and the government has done an awful lot to try to keep those flowing. Russian exports, too, of course, both volumes and especially value have fallen off a lot over the last year, particularly after the sort of some of the supply shocks from sort of last year fed through. And I know you all sort of on this channel and elsewhere have talked a lot about the impacts on Russian revenue. I think the other big thing to note is that both imports and exports into Russia in particular are increasingly either part of the military supply chain, right, procurement. You know, Russia's found it very difficult to just rely on domestic sources of equipment and inputs, but, you know, and sort of very government sort of led channels. And, you know, we can talk a bit about the sort of capital flows dynamics that have been really weighing on the ruble in the last, you know, in the last couple of months and the like.
Thanks a lot. That you're bringing a lot in one go.
My apologies.
First of all, I'll let you have the opportunity to
get into detail on some of this.
Yeah. I'm very interested in one thing, which is related to my own work. We have suppliers, a lot of suppliers, and about a year ago, the war against Ukraine had such of an impact here in Western Europe that we ate a special column in our files to mark those suppliers that were telling us that they were having problem supplying us due to the war in Ukraine. So out of the, 300 or 400 suppliers that we have, a good 40% entered that category at some point. And now we've removed that column. It's a single point. It's my personal experience. But would you say that this is something that is true across the board, that people have started to have adapted, found workarounds, and now that the direct impact of the war is, except on some very specific markets, the direct impact has almost receded completely?
So I think, yes, there's been a lot of adaptation, both, you know, sort of buyers in Western Europe, but in elsewhere, people have sort of developed new supply chains. Now, that doesn't mean, I think, you know, businesses get used to new ways of operating and finding ways to still make money or at least try to minimize losing money. and the like, I think there have been some things that have been elements of sort of good planning and some of good luck. You know, we were quite worried sort of this time last year and especially going into, you know, later in the fall and the winter about whether there would be even more extensive energy shortages, for example, in Western Europe. You know, and obviously there was a lot of conservation and choices that were made to conserve, you know, to conserve both power and, you know, and fuel. The relatively, you know, warmer winter has, you know, sort of helped, as did a willingness of entities like China to sort of resell on the supplies they had. But I know you're sort of talking about other, you know, other supply chains as well, you know, equipment, you know, sort of, you know, food and the like. So I think there was adjustments, but I also think that some of those maybe were temporary in the sense of there were some important workarounds, like, you know, the grain deal. And I know there's folks sort of in this sort of spaces that, you know, sort of track grain and related supplies even closer than I, that sort of operated relatively well for a period of some months and then sort of dribbled to a bit of a halt. From a Western European side, of course, you know, they have more options about where to sort of access those supplies. But I think there are countries now, particularly in Africa, that are, you know, that we're already facing higher food prices that now aren't sure where they're going to be able to sort of get their supplies. So I think there's definitely been adjustment. In some ways, the same thing, you know, can go if we broaden this out to a global level. I mentioned the tariffs earlier in the U.S.-China context. You know, if you look at sort of research and data, trade data, you can see that the very items that the U.S. has sizable tariffs on, on items coming from China, well, those, you know, sort of there's been a decline in those items coming from China, but an increase or a similar amount coming from other countries in Asia. So businesses do adjust. It's harder to adjust if there are supplies that can't be that can't be purchased elsewhere. Another way that businesses adjust, of course, is that, and we've seen this even with sort of Russia, has been sort of evasion of the, you know, of these sort of restrictions. You know, it's very hard to completely sort of clamp down on trade. So I think that's one of the reasons also we continue to see, you know, sort of new sanctions efforts to try to close off those loopholes. So yes, some degree of adjustment, seeking out new suppliers, seeking out new ways of paying as well, you know, because of the sanctions. So, but yes, I think that a lot of companies had to look around and say, well, how could we sort of create, you know, sort of adjust the supply chains? That's where I think it's sort of worth, sort of one of the things we sort of try to track is to what extent, you know, to what extent are trade flows actually shifting, versus to what extent is there really just an additional couple of steps before an item goes to its end user? I know that you guys have sort of tracked closely that Europe, for example, is still getting Russian LNG. There's also a dynamic on the energy side of Europe still buying refined fuel that stopped somewhere else. You know, the sort of crude oil came from Russia. It got refined somewhere else and then came through. And so one could look at it and say that maybe the final demand and an ultimate beneficiary of trade has maybe not changed quite as much as the surface data would indicate.
Okay, thank you. That was very enlightening. By the way, talking about people who track very closely the trade, I'd like to say hello to Exit, who's the lady who is following the closest in the world, everything having to do with grain. Hello, Exit. But
and Exit was definitely the person I had in mind when I talked about people in the room who follow these things much more closely than I am. And, you know, I think we all sort of are working in an environment of trying to both sort of look at the data, sort of crowdsource and triangulate, and sort of the things that people are still sharing on these platforms and others are really important for sort of the kind of scenario work and the like that I try to do, that we're all trying to do and the like. So really appreciate that despite all of the sort of question marks up and down and some on this sort of space, that there's still such a crowdsourcing of expertise tracking these issues.
Oh, by the way, left side question. How have your work been impacted by, the rise of OSINT, if there's a rise? I would call it a rise, but maybe I just don't know it very well. The rise of OSINT, the presence of people like Exit, the availability of resources that did not exist before. Have your work changed, or are you still almost entirely dependent on the sort of data emitted by national statistic agencies?
Yeah, so I guess it's interesting. I think it's, there's an element where for me, because I spent a lot of my career tracking countries where official data, wasn't necessarily enough, or that it might be manipulated or might not tell the whole story. I've spent time early in my career tracking the Chinese economy, where for many times we would sort of look at the fixed income data, and then we would also try to look at the electricity kind of production and consumption data and see whether those lined up, right? Because certain things are easier to either manipulate or the like. For a good point of the last, also working on, working on a variety of countries in the Middle East where data quality is not what it might be in even other sort of emerging economies, where you sort of have to triangulate, you have to put different things together, and you have to, as an analyst, not just focus and over-focus on the areas where data is available, right? You have to sort of come up with proxies. So I guess all I'm saying is that I have a bit of experience having to sort of look and say, well, here's the thing, we're trying to understand what data might be available, either from an official source or from, sort of people aggregating it, or just, when I started to work on the impact of sanctions on Iran more than a decade ago, we spent time doing what people now do for Russia of tracking Chinese and Indian and Japanese data to see that, to sort of see what the real sort of trade dynamics might be reported by those trading partners. So, I guess all I'm saying is that there was always kind of a healthy maybe if skepticism or check on official data sources and trying to get the best idea while recognizing you have to have a lot of humility as a forecaster. So that's number one. I think that both Russia's war in Ukraine and even before that, the pandemic meant that a lot of people, myself included, started to rely more on different sources of data, including some higher frequency data that might come in about sort of consumption and trade and the like. And that's definitely been the case. So, for example, in the context of tracking the war economy, I spend a lot more time benefiting from the work that folks like Tanker Trackers and Kepler and other sort of people in other commodities are doing to really try to figure out where each tanker is going. I pay more attention to the aggregated up story, perhaps, than some other people in this space. But, these are entities that benefit from satellite technology that have been very smart, rising product of aggregate this. And I think it's something that's really important for not only policymaking, but also investing. So I guess there's an element where, the important thing is also recognizing, sort of what are the data points that might be more likely to be manipulated and politicized. So I use a mixture of both, or maybe more than both.
Yeah, that's very interesting. All the more because it dovetails with this other aspect that you were explaining earlier of the fact that an increasing amount of the trade is becoming, it's starting to play on the line between legal and illegal. Once upon a time, trading, chips around the world was, completely legal. There was no problem. And now it's becoming more and more difficult to do that. Does the move towards more the darker, a grayer type of trade affect your work as well?
It does. Both because it's harder for us to really understand what both the trade flows are, but and also the relative sort of wealth and income there that they're generating. Also, it affects the work because I think the more trade is done through illicit channels, the more barter operations, the more that you sort of might have several different sources, sets of illicit activity taking place in the same murky undercurrents of the global economy. And then, of course, it makes the lives of other people, policymakers and those trying to implement policies, it makes their lives a lot harder, of course, because as things go more and more underground, it is harder to sort of use some of the either targeted or sort of, you know, quite, you know, blunt tools, whether it's sanctions or the like, to choke things off. Like, for example, you know, I spend a certain amount of time trying to not only track what's going on sort of Russian energy trade through the context of the price cap and the like, but also tracking the sort of illicit trade flows going from Iran to China. And so not only does it make it harder for me to sort of understand, you know, what underlying demand in China for energy, what, you know, how much revenue Iran is making, how much revenue other people are making, what they might be spending it on. And all of these issues also sort of come back to sort of those of us who are sort of trying to think about Russia's sort of, you know, military procurement budgets and things like that. So it's definitely made things more difficult. I think it's also, this is also happening from a business side. I think businesses are being asked to pay a lot more attention to their supply chains, who their suppliers are, who's going to be using their products, or else they might face fines. Now, this is something that I would say companies in Europe and in Western allies, you know, maybe are more sensitive to than those in some emerging market economies. But I think that there are folks in a wide set of sectors that are now having to pay attention and do their due diligence in a very different way, you know, than they did some years ago. And of course, I should say it's not only a function of Russia's war on Ukraine. It's also a function of people weren't paying attention to how a global pandemic might impact their supply chain and business proposition. So I think they're both internal and external drivers of that.
Very interesting. For me, there's a debate, and I'd love you to take side in it, or to tell me the debate is completely uninteresting. But the debate is the following. On the one hand, we have the sort of Martin Wolf's of the world. Martin Wolf, the FT economic commentator, who's basically saying that the world that we were seeing emerge in the early 2000s, where there was free markets, ever freer markets in the world with ever more complex supply chains, as well as a state that was constantly withdrawing from directing and planning the economy, that world seems to have shattered for a number of reasons that you've put forward. And on the other hand, there's also the factor that nowadays you have entire wars where non-state supply chains are having a very important impact. So if you're looking, for instance, at one of the most critical material of the war, which is drones. Many and potentially most of the drones today are bought either by the soldiers themselves or by associations such as the one headed by our friend Constantine. And so we suddenly have the impression that the state is not doing what it used to do best, and at the same time is coming back in the economic sphere where we thought it would have been gone. So what is your, where do you land in that debate? More state or less state? What are we witnessing?
Well, I think we definitely are in a position where there's more state involvement. I guess I might take issue with the frame of how much states were really withdrawing in the 2000s. I mean, just because I think early in the 2000s, yes, there was both a narrative around globalization and interconnection and business involvement. I think the context of the global financial crisis brought state support back in a number of ways. You know, one can sort of question how far, you know, sort of China's state or at least the party withdrew. And some of the dynamics of choices that China made, I think, both encouraged other countries to sort of continue to have some degree of a state, you know, sort of state role, but also maybe belatedly encourage Western countries to take on more of a state role. Even through the, you know, mid-2000s and especially the sort of earlier part of the last decade, you know, we continue to have some major government-linked investment bodies. I'm thinking about sovereign wealth funds and other SOEs sort of, you know, take on large roles, especially in countries that perhaps were prime, you know, were looking to utilize their resource wealth to develop in other ways. So I think, but clearly various things have happened, and there is more, more of a role of the state. Now, I think you highlight an important point, which is sometimes either states don't have enough money or sort of capacity to get things done, or the sort of private sector can get things done more quickly, or cases where, especially in a war economy, it's necessary for states to kind of co-opt private sector actors and, you know, sort of to help people get done what's necessary. Some of that, I think, is also a function of the rise of social media and the ability to outsource and crowdfund and the like. It's devastating. That's something that needs to, you know, happen, but that sort of story. So, again, even though I think you see a lot more sort of state-led development, not only in emerging markets, including some where that was always kind of a bit the story, but I do think you see much more relevance, willingness of the U.S., of the European Union, of Japan, Canada, to either use state-led restrictive tools or to sort of use a combination of incentives and investments to drive economic development. You know, you mentioned at the outset industrial policy. You know, I think that, you know, I tend to be a believer that there may be some things that some government priming can help and setting things sort of moving. That leads to a whole set of issues around how do you pick winners and losers? How do you exit? Because government expansion of balance sheets is not sustainable. How do you, you know, if it's a country like, say, Saudi Arabia, where the government investment fund is, you know, probably crowding out some more investment entities, how do you think about future exits? I mean, these things are the case. But I mean, I think if you can look around the world and not only see dynamics like the IRA and the CHIPS Act in the U.S. that involve a greater use of sort of government funding and government balance sheets, but we can also look at the willingness to utilize tools like the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and the like. So I think there is, you know, so I do think there's more, you know, sort of more state involved. The question mark will be, you know, to what extent does, you know, can, you know, are some of these industrial policies and state actions a form of crowding in the private sector? Also of sort of stepping up where maybe the private sector isn't the right one to provide versus does this sort of state and other actors get overextended? And, you know, I think you can look around and, you know, say that one of the risks is as the state gets involved in certain areas that they, you know, sort of may not do as well some other sort of service, you know, service provisions. So, you know, it's a big topic that I think we're all going to be sort of grappling with. So I guess I end up coming in perhaps somewhere in the middle, which may not help.
Well, thank you. So the fight will continue. Maybe let me follow up on this. You have, as you said, many clients that are both in the private and the public sector. Do the questions that they both ask you, have they changed over the past few months or few years? So are the people from more state side sort of people, have they started to ask more economic minded questions, and have people from the private sector started to be ever more interested in what the state doing?
So I guess, you know, some of the question is there's a selection bias element, right? Because I think for a long time I've been someone that works at the intersection of politics and geopolitics and sort of global macro and markets, right? So there have probably been times where even though I was working on sort of macroeconomic issues, you know, there were times a decade ago or so that I'd go in and talk to clients, sort of asset managers, and they would be like, well, we don't think politics matters so much, right? Or maybe it does on a domestic level. There'd even be times where certain types of investors would say broad macro trends don't matter as much. Well, I think this sort of, this is a good company and, you know, they can, you know, sort of they can do well. So I think there are cycles. But still, I mean, as someone whose work has been at the intersection of not only politics and economics, but also tends to work on countries where politics is at least as important as economics, I have a bit of a selection bias. But what I will say is that the questions people ask have shifted, though. I think there are interest and questions from a much wider set of sectors. There are people who, for example, didn't used to think export controls would affect them because they're not in the military supply chain, for example. There are people that thought they could, you know, avoid, you know, so, you know, that they weren't, say, subject to sanctions because, you know, they didn't trade with Iran or they didn't trade with Syria or, you know, sort of fill in the blank country. And I think with there being increased targeting of larger entities, particularly in Russia and China, due to Russia's aggression and illicit and malign activities, of course, there's a lot more sort of, you know, interest there. So these things shift. I also think that, you know, some of the challenges is sort of the other, I think, but I do think one of the big other areas where things have shifted is that we are starting to see this whole effort around both sort of nearshoring and remaking supply chains in ways that are trying to grapple with vulnerabilities associated with the energy transition and the like, critical mineral supply chains and so on. And so I think there also are more questions about energy. There also are more questions about how industrial policy is going to work and what that's going to look like. So there are areas definitely of difference. And I think it's harder for businesses just to say, well, we won't invest in areas that are, you know, sort of subject to these political issues, when I think there is, you know, a greater portion of the global economy that's subject to sort of sanctions and other restrictions. They may not trade directly with Russia, but people have to monitor their supply chains in a different way.
Okay, thank you very much. Usually I like to ask a question in the last 5 minutes, which is a bit of a carte blanche sort of question. But considering that you tend to have a lot to say, I'm going to ask it now, and maybe it's going to carry us for the next 20 minutes, hopefully. So usually the question is there something that we're missing? Is there a very interesting question that I've forgotten to ask? But in this case, I'd like to phrase it a little bit differently. Imagine I'm either a very, very committed pro-Ukrainian Western decision maker, either in the private or public sector, or even a Ukrainian decision maker. And I turn to you and I say, okay, are there still some low-hanging fruits, things that we can do to truly affect Russia at the moment, and more specifically, Russian trade and the balance and their finances? Is there something that can be done, or do you think that, yes, of course, the sanction regime as it is can be improved, but it's just more of the same that's in the works?
Yeah, it's a very good question. You asked about the what can be done on the economic side, and I think there are additional things one can do. I think that I do really think that the U.S. and allies need to think more seriously about how to deal with the leakiness of the price cap and other dynamics, because I think that's adding to additional Russian revenues. I know the concern is that oil prices might spike up, and that is a concern. But I just think that what's happening is that more and more sort of elements of the fleet are going to, are sort of ending up in this ghost fleet. Ultimately, and it's not to sort of kick the tires or sort of ask someone else to do things, but I think we're also, though, seeing a dynamic where the economic sides of this campaign are important. They're leading to sort of structural vulnerabilities. You're doing a lot of things, but I think ultimately with a country like Russia that is, whose, you know, regime is willing to incur a lot of losses and to jettison a lot of long-term interests, whether it's participation in energy transition or hydrogen or elsewhere, I think that ultimately some of the more things we can do are probably not so much on the economic warfare or statecraft side, but are more on the both financing and support of Ukraine, and also sort of what can be done to aid on the military side. I know that, you know, there's a little bit of me sitting here as an economist where it sort of, you know, seems like I'm passing the buck a bit. But, you know, I do think ultimately, particularly since the sort of economic bleeding isn't necessarily going to sort of lead to resolution or negotiations. It can help. It can make things more difficult. But I think ultimately it's about the, you know, sort of the military dynamics. Now, of course, anything relating to both military aid and, you know, sort of government support and other things like that become, I think, a bit harder and harder as the conflict goes on, and particularly the political cycle in the United States. You know, I'm heartened that before they went away, before they went away for recess, that Congress had avoided attempts to sort of cut back on financing of Ukraine. I think there's a lot of commitment from the Biden administration to sort of continue on. But, you know, we know that the sort of political dynamics are getting more, getting more difficult in that regard. What else on the economic side? I think it's going to be really important. And again, there are other people, you know, sort of on, you know, sort of in this room that can probably speak to this as well. But really trying to think about the alternate ways of getting grain and food onto the global market, particularly from Ukraine, but to avoid playing into the hands of sort of Russia's attempt to further weaponize sort of grain markets. That's partly because, you know, trying to make sure that other countries don't buy into Russia's arguments of the politicization. It's not easy to create new channels. It's especially not easy to create new channels with the increased militarization in the Black Sea. But I do think that it's been a little too far off the radar of certain U.S. and especially European policymakers. And I think that's really important to carry on and sort of think about, you know, the response of the global South. So those are a few ideas. But yeah, you know, I'll have to think about some more and hope we can kind of stay in touch on all of this. So I guess it's a combination of close some of the loopholes, you know, think about what can sort of be done to further wean Western Europe, for example, off of Russian natural gas, because then that's something that I think is going to sort of, you know, come up, especially the LNG side, and try to think about some more creative ideas on grain, you know, sort of grain to, you know, sort of grain to market and the like. So those are a few of them. And as I say, I'm particularly going to be watching when things sort of get back up to sort of full capacity in, you know, Washington and Brussels and elsewhere, sort of what happens to the energy, the oil price cap and the like. So sorry for rambling there a little bit.
No, that's very good points. I guess that Europe, I'm thinking about Europe because the United States as a producer is a bit in a different situation, but Europe is going to have to pay a lot of money one way or another to win itself from Russia. And you're perfectly right that that money, instead of being used in a purely reactive manner, for instance, by helping households buy energy when the prices of energy are going to be higher, we could be spending it now, even as a state, to develop LNG alternatives that would be more, you know, more friendly towards us. That's very, very good point. Thanks a lot for raising it.
I mean, one of the challenges on the LNG side, European buyers face, you know, a couple of dynamics. They would like to, you know, having had this wake-up call early last year, maybe a little bit too late, you know, sort of too little too late, of their vulnerabilities with Russia, now are trying to think about how do they avoid vulnerabilities with others. Europe rightly, I think, has aggressive commitments on the climate side and energy transition, which leave questions about what the role of natural gas is going to be after 2030, and especially after 2035. And that means that Europe is less willing to sign long-term contracts than, for example, their Chinese counterparts, right? And that leaves sort of European consumers arguably a little bit more at the mercy of sellers, you know, sort of continuing to go ahead with some of the things that are in Repower EU and some of the battery sort of support and technologies to try to rely on more, to rely on alternate sources. But I think some of it is also just being realistic about what the energy supply is going to look like, not just in the next 4 or 5 years, but also beyond and the like. And of course, this sort of also intersects with demands and concerns and wake-up calls that have come from belatedly from the sort of extreme heat and climactic, you know, extremes that we're seeing.
Thanks a lot. You mentioned sanctions, and I have to admit that while I'm a strong proponent of a lot of sanctions, there is one type of sanction that makes me, I wouldn't say uncomfortable, because there's a moral aspect to it, which sits perfectly well with me, but there's, in terms of economic efficiency, this is the individual sanctions. Mm. Do you think they're having an impact? And if they do, what impact? And if they don't, do you think they can be fixed? Or do you think they just are valuable as a sort of moral or quasi-legal punishment that we're trying to impose on those people?
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think in general, I think a lot of individual and even policymaker, individual person sanctions. And obviously, if you're a policymaker, it's a little bit different than if you're a private individual and so on. I am skeptical of their impact. That being said, I think that they had a role, especially in sort of sending a message about the costs of doing business with Russia, for example, in the context here. I'm probably a little more critical of individual sanctions in the context of other countries, places like Iran or elsewhere that are already subject to such quite extensive sectoral sanctions that and sort of secondary sanctions that targeting a judicial player, you know, involved in a jail. Yeah, I'm not sure that that does much beyond making Western policymakers feel good. There's some of that as well, I think, in the Russia sanctions. I mean, I do think we have to look back and think about why individual sanctions were imposed. I think there was a hope and a view that by putting pressure on particularly rich Russian affiliate, you know, Russians or those affiliated abroad, that it would lead to economic pressure that would be put on Putin and then lead to the end of the war, or at least would reduce the availability of sort of capital to flow sort of back and forth. There definitely, for some of these oligarchs and these individuals, have been ways of conveniently sort of transferring the funds and, you know, finding other ways around it. So there are probably some things that could be done. I think more generally, it's as a reminder of it's really important for us to sort of try to map and think about what's really effective. And, you know, if something's not being effective, maybe some of the things get lifted. But in general, I do worry that a lot of the individual sanctions are more symbolic rather than impactful. And, you know, whereas sort of focusing on these major trade flows, if anything, I think one of the things that we've seen has been a bit more of a focus towards both the trade sanctions, the export controls, and the financial sanctions that are designed to actually implement export controls. And that's where I think we're watching what's going to happen with the new EU tools that allows some secondary or sort of secondary minus sort of sanctions to come into effect. I'm probably not too optimistic on their success, in part because of the need to get all 27 member states to agree. But that is an issue, you know, sort of more generally. So, you know, I think that, yeah, so as you can tell, I'm sort of a bit skeptical about individual sanctions.
Okay. And you think that the fact that it's primarily aiming at Russians who are part of what economists call the offshore aristocracy and who are also one of the main providers of capital towards the Russian economy. Do you think that this has had an effect on them?
I think that it has had an effect. Now, of course, I think that there's some people subject to these sanctions that were major suppliers of sort of capital back in Russia, but these were also people that had chosen to have their money abroad, and some of them had chosen to live outside of Russia and had arguably only tangential ties. And so I think it was difficult to differentiate between the two. But look, I mean, I think it's clear to me that some of these actors, especially some of the state-affiliated ones, that they're trying so hard to have them lifted, clearly they're having an effect. Is that effect bringing the war to a close sort of more quickly? It's hard to tell.
Thanks a lot. I do have a few other questions for you, but most importantly, I guess there is the one about the sectors. Is there a sector that you think has been particularly affected and that you would like to dive into?
Globally or within Russia or both?
Oh, I wasn't thinking within Russia, but yeah.
Well, one of the examples that I think I and a lot of people point to is that one of the sectors that's been, I mean, to illustrate this point I alluded to earlier, which is that Russia's economy has been so sort of focused around the government and, you know, sort of the state-run sector, the military procurement, all of these dynamics. And one of the ones that, of course, has been particularly hit and really hasn't recovered has been the automotive production sort of sector. Now, some of that was, you know, a reliance and integration with European producers. Some of it was, you know, concerns and limitations even of Russian relationships with China. But the fact that sort of production fell so sharply and really has yet to recover, I think, highlights the limitations on sort of capital, but also, you know, the real refocus on sort of military change. And it's been interesting because that's happened at the same time where, if anything, Russian imports of used cars from Asia and new cars, especially electric vehicles from China, have really been on an upswing. So it's clearly not a story about a certain Russian's ability to pay and more about, you know, sort of the capability of both sourcing materials, but also this preference and focus on military supply chains instead of civilian supply chains in that way. So that's just something, you know, continue to watch. And also, I think that element of particularly the sharp increase in Russian imports of Chinese cars and trucks, which I would say is actually not unique to Russia-China trade. It's something we've seen Chinese electric vehicle sales globally really skyrocket in the last year. But I think it kind of adds to some of the concerns that the Russians have about, the sort of one-sided nature of the relationship. You know, in terms of sectors, clearly we've seen sort of major impact on food and fertilizer sectors, especially grain and fertilizer, both because of the sanctions on Russia and Belarus, as well as the other sort of dynamics that reinforces the impact of higher costs of natural gas, because another way to make fertilizer is, you know, sort of byproducts from natural gas. You know, I think, and of course, there are sort of sectors, including accommodation and other things like that, the countries where both Ukrainians and Russians have sort of ended up, you know, fleeing their country and the like. You know, I mean, some of it just depends. And then you could look at it and, you know, it's always difficult in a war context to think about, you know, relative winners. But I do think that, you know, entities like drone manufacturers, whether they're in Turkey or whether they're in Iran or whether they're in Western countries, for example, and sort of military suppliers have definitely seen an increase in demand, which is honestly something you want to see. But that's something, sort of watching. And two, I think there's a broader question mark down the line as I'm thinking about reshaping of sectors, which is how third countries, like whether it's Saudi Arabia and the UAE or elsewhere, are looking at particular not only the export controls on Russia, but also the U.S. export controls and technology restrictions on China to think about how they can either stockpile or develop their own technology systems. I mean, it's probably not really their own. It's more about adapting some of the dynamics that they're getting from technology transfer from China and the like. So those are some of the things I'm watching. I mean, it's a little bit of a scattershot sort of sector story, but maybe we can continue the conversation in the coming days, weeks, and months, and as we're all tracking.
Yeah, that I would absolutely love to. So there are a number of questions that are going to stay on the table. You mentioned Turkey. I was about to ask you about Turkey, but you've already been speaking for over an hour, and I dare not impose on you. I'll let you conclude, and then I'll say goodbye to everyone.
Great. Thank you. No, I mean, look, I think this is all happening at a time when a lot of countries, Turkey among them, are looking and trying to avoid being in one camp or the other. This is, I think, a function of the sort of Russia's war in Ukraine. It's also a function of other geoeconomic shifts. And I think some of the challenge will be, continues to be getting the message out that brutal wars and invasions of neighbors are not okay, that countries concerned about the U.S. weaponization of key supply chains shouldn't mix up the different goals. And I think it's important not to fall too much into the trap of think about new ways of counteracting some of the Russian information campaigns in the emerging world. But maybe that's a topic both other people sort of in this group are sort of more able to sort of speak to, but also is an ongoing sort of discussion. But thank you, as always, sort of thoughtful questions, and happy to stay in touch with you guys. And I know we didn't have a chance for sort of other folks to ask questions, but people should feel free to be in touch if I can help and other ideas. So I appreciate the chance to participate and all the work that you're doing to elevate these critical topics and policy ideas.
Thanks a lot, Rachel. That was an absolute treat. There, I'll keep in mind your idea on the being proactive when it comes to the future of energy, and I'd like to thank you really, really a lot. That was fantastic. People, if you're not following Rachel, you absolutely should. If you're following her, you should follow her again, just for the sake of. Thank you everyone for listening to us again. Thank you, Rachel. And us at Vlachny are telling you goodbye. See you on Sunday when for Vlachny Weekly, we'll be covering the main news of the week and dive as far as we can in diverse subjects such as economics, culture, and of course the military situation. Thank you, everyone. Again, thank you, Rachel, and have a wonderful, wonderful day.
Thank you.